It's Crime and Time.
On the rocks.
On the rocks.
On the rocks.
With salt.
With salt. Like salt.
So we are drinking the Paloma.
So when I was looking at picture or story ideas, I saw that although the margarita is considered to be Mexico's national drink, it should really be the Paloma.
Oh, it totally should be the Paloma.
Yeah.
So when I was just recently in Mexico, we were drinking Palomas.
Jenny.
Yeah. We were drinking Palomas a lot, except for my friend that went with me. She was drinking them with vodka because she doesn't do tequila.
Me neither.
But I like the Paloma. And everywhere was using the Jaritos grapefruit soda, mm-hmm. which I love. And I bought some recently, but I went to the store today to get it for our ingredient. Could not find it. So we're using another grapefruit soda.
Does it start with an S?
It starts with an S.
That's my favorite soda.
So this is tequila, grapefruit soda, lime juice, and salted rim.
Okay. I have drank or used this soda as a mixer with vodka a lot.
The bartenders at the place we were at, mostly drinking them because we had a all-inclusive wristband, they had varying degrees of skill with this drink. You would think it would be an easy one, but
yeah.
Some of them were just literally like iced tequila grapefruit soda. And others like muddled the lime, put a little grapefruit in there. And I'm like, I need to remember which ones make it the way I like it.
Right. And what was your preference?
I like a little, I definitely got to have some lime. And the muddled grapefruit was nice, but mm-hmm. I did not do that this time for us.
If you hear the ice clanking, it's because I'm scooping my salt inside. And I'm probably going to have to get more salt because not
I gave you the glass with
fan.
The more salt on
yes.
it.
Yes.
All right. I'm going to try mine.
Okay. I'll try mine too.
I really like that.
Yep. I'm going to put a little salt in it, but I do like it.
So,
I'm also going to get some paper towels because it's leaving rings on the table.
Yes. Two paper towels, please.
Two paper towels coming up. And salt. And as another podcast that I listen to is recently been being advertised, Bounty Selecticize. We're open to that as well.
We have Kirkland Selecticize, I'm guessing.
We do. Because we're a Costco family. We're drinking Kirkland Hard Seltzer, Kirkland Margarita Salt, Kirkland sitting on Kirkland furniture.
All right. So do you want me to go first?
Sure. While I fix my drink.
I'm going to tell you about Pepsi Paloma.
Ooh.
So Pepsi Paloma was born Delia Duena Smith in 1966.
So she chose the name Pepsi.
She was given the name Pepsi.
Oh, okay.
So she was the eldest of four children. She was raised by a single mother in the Philippines. Their father, he was an American mail carrier, and he left while the children were all still very young. So at 14, a talent scout named Tita Esther brought Pepsi Paloma to a talent manager named Ray De La Cruz and wanted to get her started in movies. The Philippines had their own, like, film industry.
Okay.
So by 1981, they had given her the name Pepsi Paloma, and she starred in a movie called Brown Emmanuel. The reason why they gave her the name Pepsi Paloma is because they had this whole series of actresses that were called the soft drink beauties.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So
is there a reasoning behind that?
Just a marketing gimmick. So Ray De La Cruz, who was her manager, he's the one that came up with this gimmick. And beside the soft drink beauties, there was also street beauties, which were named after like prominent streets, and alcohol beauties.
I'd rather be an alcohol beauty.
Yeah. They were all really young, the soft drink beauties.
Yeah.
And they were in the film industry, but they were considered bold stars, which was a type of softcore porn.
Oh,
so
hey.
They did these films. One of them was called Naked Island. Another one was called Snake Sisters. And unfortunately for the soft
drink... Snake Sisters takes on a whole new meaning when you're talking porn.
Yeah, softcore. It wasn't hardcore. So they all the soft drink beauties, unfortunately, had short careers. The first one was...
So they're doing, sorry, this just dawned on me. They're young, they're named after soft drinks, and they're doing softcore porn.
Mm-hmm.
Any contradictions there that anybody's seeing?
Right, like starting at like 16 years old. So the first one was Coca Nicholas. So Coca-Cola, Coca Nicholas, she ended up cutting her career short because of alcohol, drugs, and poor financial management. Then there
doesn't
was
sound like the porn industry at all.
No. Then there was Sarsi Emanuel. Sarsi was a soft drink in the Philippines, or is a soft drink.
I was just going to ask.
Yeah. She started acting at age 20, so a little bit older than the others. But she left acting in the 90s. So she only acted for like less than a decade. And she went on just to have a normal life. So good for her. And then Pepsi Paloma. So Pepsi started appearing in all these films. One was called Virgin People. She appeared in Naked Island. In 1982, she was in a comedy show. It was called Iskul Bakul. Forgive me if I'm not getting my Tagalog pronunciations correctly.
I can't even pronounce Tagalog, so you're doing better than me.
So she went. She was on this comedy show with another Filipino actress. And after they were done filming for the day, Paloma claimed that their shirts were ripped open by the three MCs, and then all three of the men took turns kissing her. So these three men were Vic Soto, Joey De Leon, and Richie DeHorsey, whose real name was Ricardo Reyes. Literally Richie DeHorsey.
Yeah.
So
Richie the horse?
Yeah, Richie DeHorsey. Which is a terrible name to give yourself.
Yes. But again, porn industry. I mean, I know softcore, but still.
No, he wasn't in the porn industry.
Oh, okay.
He was in the comedy industry.
Oh, gotcha.
So
that makes sense too.
Yeah. So the men, according to Paloma, apparently pinned her arms back, and then they let Vic kiss her while Joey took photographs.
Oh my.
Yeah. So later that evening, Paloma and the other unnamed actress went to room 210 at the nearby Sulo Hotel. She claims they were brought there. This hotel was a favorite hangout of the TV station hosts, which were the three men I mentioned. They hosted the comedy show because it had affordable coffee and food. So, anyway, they were staying there for the night, apparently to party and have affordable coffee and food,
Yes.
So, after that incident, Paloma reported to authorities that she and the other actress were drugged and raped by the three hosts.
Oh, my.
And the story made the headlines in all of the major Filipino entertainment magazines, which apparently there was several.
Oh.
And Ray De La Cruz, who was her manager, filed a complaint with the defense minister. Vic Soto's brother, who was also an actor and eventually became a senator in the Philippines, he got involved and he basically compelled Paloma to drop the charges. So the allegation is
That's not nice.
No. So the allegation is that he intimidated her with a gun and made her sign an affidavit to request the charges be dropped. But other reports say that Paloma's mother signed the document on her behalf because she was still a minor.
Oh my goodness.
And it was also reported that Paloma agreed to drop the charges in exchange for a public apology, which...
But then he would be admitting that he did it.
They did do the apology, though. So they were on TV, they dropped onto their knees, and they gave her an apology.
Wow.
Yeah.
On television, they dropped to their knees.
Mm-hmm.
So they admitted that they were guilty of this incident.
To some sort. I couldn't see what the full apology consisted of, but anyway.
And I would think, isn't this a criminal charge?
Yeah.
So I would think if they admitted it on television or, you know, apologized for it on television, that it would go anyway, whether or not she wanted to press charges.
I guess. I mean, I don't know how the Filipino criminal justice system works, but anyway.
And she could have recanted her statement too.
Yeah. And I do know this because I wrote this down right here, that in the Philippines, if the men had been found guilty of the charges, they would have faced the death penalty.
Holy goodness.
Yeah, and been executed in the electric chair.
Wow.
So it wasn't a light charge.
No. So they're kind of begging for their lives at this point.
Yeah. So this whole scenario mirrored a case that happened 20 years prior with another actress named Maggie De La Riva. And she was raped by four men, and three of the four of those men were ultimately executed.
Wow. I would think I mean, I don't know because I'm not a rapist, but I would think that the potential to be executed would be a pretty big deterrent to forcing a woman to have, I mean, I would think that would just stop date rape right there because I could die.
Especially being like a pseudo celebrity, or maybe they were full on celebrities. Like, you would think they wouldn't really have to resort to rape. So obviously if they did do that, they made that conscious choice.
Yeah. And knowing full well that the penalty is potentially death. The death penalty.
That's... Or did they think they were above the law?
There are celebrities who think that.
Mm-hmm.
In every country.
Yeah, exactly. So, anyway, Paloma, like, during this whole time, goes missing.
Oh.
So, they finally find her, and she was being held captive by this convicted felon whose name was Bienvenido Mendoza, and they called him Ben Ulo. So, he was a relative of the Soto brothers.
Oh.
And he was arrested, and he confessed to kidnapping her and holding her captive, but he was never charged with a crime.
So who do these guys know in the government?
Yes. Which I didn't see when the second Soto brother eventually became a senator, but I mean, he must have had some sort of connections already.
I was just listening to an Unsolved Mysteries on Chandra Levy.
Oh,
speaking
yeah.
Speaking of congressmen and senators.
I mean, he was innocent, though.
Yes, he was. And I didn't really have an opinion on the case until I was listening to the podcast. I'm like, well, obviously, he didn't do it.
I did have an opinion, and it was that his wife didn't have a finger, a thumb, right? Wasn't it?
That detail did not come out in this podcast.
Yeah, so Gary Condit's wife was missing a thumb or something like that.
Oh.
Or at least a finger.
Interesting.
And I thought, that's a weird fact to include.
That is a weird fact, because it did not come up in this one. That reminds me of The Handmaid's Tale. Did she get it cut off because she read?
I didn't get to that part. Spoiler alert.
That was way off track.
I'm only on episode...
The series is like, what, 10 years old? 5 years old?
I'm still watching it. I'm on episode 3.
I have not watched Game of Thrones, so if you want to spoil that for me, go ahead.
I don't want to watch Game of Thrones.
I do, because it's the Huguenots. It's the War of the Roses.
I watched a couple episodes of it, and I was like, this isn't for me. This is probably fabulous for somebody that's into it, but this is not for me.
Yeah. I'll watch it someday.
Yeah, I won't. So the Sotos did an interview for a magazine, and the magazine was published in 1982, and they were able to tell their side of the story. They said that Paloma and the other woman came to them, that they were not brought there. Mm-hmm. They came, you know, on their own. And they claimed that after the filming wrapped up for the day, both of the actresses wanted souvenir photos of the men kissing them.
Mm.
So Tito Soto said there were only 2 photos taken, one showing Vic wearing sunglasses and kissing Pepsi, and the other showing Joey kissing Pepsi. And he said that was a really awkward photo because it looked like Pepsi was trying to get out of an embrace, which is a little creepy to me.
Yes, especially if they're the ones requesting the photos. I don't think she would be trying to get away if she had requested the photo.
Yeah, and he claimed that the reason why it looked awkward is because Pepsi was trying to get out of the embrace because she had bubblegum in her mouth and she wanted to spit it out. And he denied that their blouses had been ripped open. So Tito, who's the other Soto brother that wasn't involved at, you know, for the incident,
mm-hmm.
He wasn't present when the alleged rape took place, but he said there's no way Vic could have been involved because he was too frail or skinny to beat a woman in arm wrestling, let alone sexually violate them.
Okay, that's a lame excuse.
Mm-hmm. That's really poor.
Because there's other methods of intimidation than
physical force. Well, especially if they were drugged.
Right.
So, at the arraignment, Joey De Leon wore a shirt that said, Coke is it, in a tasteless reference to Pepsi being a soft drink beauty. And then, during a press interview after the arraignment, Joey said, martial law should be declared again, so press freedom will be stopped.
That's a bit extreme.
Yeah. Because it doesn't suit you, so you don't want the press to be talking about
right.
your story.
And then there's the fact that she was kidnapped by one of their relatives.
Duh, I know. So...
how do you explain that away?
I know. Like, it doesn't... people just don't randomly get kidnapped by relatives of people that...
They're accusing of crimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So a year after the rape, an obscenity case was filed against Pepsi after she was caught in an indecent dance performance. And so the Criminal Investigative Service in the Philippines filed this case against her. So Pepsi has this downward spiral. She leaves her manager. She becomes addicted to drugs. Finally, in 1983, she decides to go back to her manager. But she was so frail and thin that not only could she not have raped someone, she had to be taken to a clinic.
Oh.
Yeah. So then she decides to star in a movie. It's called The Victim. It was basically written about her experience, but it was really exploitative. So it was like a sensationalized
version.
Yeah, it wasn't like tasteful or anything.
Well, if
all.
She's already kind of traumatized, because it sounds like she is turning to a life of, you know, drugs and alcohol, why would she choose to do this?
Mm-hmm.
Where it's just going to traumatize her further.
It's sad.
To relive it.
So on May 31st, 1985, which today is May 31st, the day we're recording this.
It is!
So however many days to this day, 36 years to the day. That's how fast I did the math.
1985?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought you said 95 at first. I'm like, nuh-uh.
36 years to the day.
Look at that.
I knew that math because I'm 46 and I was born in 75. So Paloma was found dead hanging in her closet.
Oh.
So she had a 6-inch long cotton sash tied around her neck. Police believe she took her own life between 1 and 2 p.m. that day, but she wasn't found until 6 p.m. So her 15-year-old brother and her boyfriend are the ones that discovered her. The brother, his name is Zaldi, he said that after lunch, she went up to her room and she told her aides to not wake her up and she locked herself in a room. So around 3, the boyfriend called, but he didn't get an answer. So he basically told Zaldi to go try to wake her up. So Zaldi knocked on the door. Nobody answered again. So the boyfriend showed up around 6, and he and the brother broke down the door. They tried to wake her up, but she was dead.
That's sad.
And she left a suicide note and wrote in it, "This is a crazy planet." So the Filipino newspaper got access to her diary, and they reported that she wrote of all these financial problems, that she didn't have enough movie roles, there were a lot of family problems, and that her mom was emotionally distant. So typical, I mean, downward spiral kind of stuff. The Paloma's current manager, Babette Corcura, she disputed that Paloma was depressed. She said that she was earning plenty of money. She had just adopted a 4-month-old son. She had been booked for a bunch of dancing performances.
That's tragic.
Yeah, that's really sad.
If you can't find joy in a 4-month-old, then that's very sad, because they're just so sweet.
I was about to make a really tasteless joke and I stopped myself. So after Paloma's death, they didn't do any type of forensic investigation. They did not verify whether the diary actually belonged to her. Sarcy Emmanuel, one of the other soft drink beauties, said that Paloma had previously attempted suicide a week prior to her actual death, and that there were a bunch of other previous attempts. One time she tried to cut herself with a blade, but her manager, De La Cruz, stopped her right in the nick of time. So there is a lot of evidence that shows that she did actually commit suicide, that it wasn't anything suspicious, but obviously her family is not...
Well, it's also hard to hang someone as a murderer.
Yes.
You would have to drug them. And if there were no drugs found in her body, then...
Yeah. So in 2014, this case came back up again because the band The Eraserheads wrote a song about what happened to her called Spellarium. And there's also a Facebook page seeking justice for what happened to her. So I have a little bit of the song right here. And this is translated from Tagalog. So the wording is a little clunky. It's not like lyrical. But so it says, "It's getting dark around someone called my name. Night when it happened. 11th floor. The rape happened in the Torch Hotel room. At the same time, reaching for a glass. Someone is waiting. They are drinking. Can I stop the rotation of the world? First, they are drunk or stupid. I'm not in the car anymore. Everything is just drawing in my throat. The crime is happening. You don't know and we don't know. Who has a plan? Who is the mastermind of the crime? Cry in the morning. Of course, cry. What did Entang and Joey write there in the gold mirror? What did Entang and Joey do? I know. I can't read anymore because someone deleted. The case was settled. Allegedly, Tito Soto paid a settlement.
They use names in the song.
Yeah, so this was, it was hard to research because some of it was in a foreign language that I do not speak or read. But I used PepsiPaloma.com, Wikipedia, Esquire Magazine, Filipino, as in K-N-O-W, which is cute, and the Epic Times.
Wow. Interesting.
Did not, like, it's just something I had never heard anything about, so.
Yeah. Well, apparently it's pretty big in the Philippines. They have people writing songs about it 30 years later.
And, like, multiple, like, the blog that I found had, like, 20 or 30 news sources, but some of them weren't in English, so.
Wow. Huh. Very cool. I mean, not cool. It's horrible, but interesting. All right. So this is another case of my teaching career dictating my topics.
Because as you do.
I cannot believe I have grown up my entire life in California, have vacationed multiple times in Mexico, live in Northern California where we have a very large population that immigrates from Mexico, and I had never heard of this person. Sadly, super big old gap in my history education, and that's shameful.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, until I had to teach him. But so my sources are Biography, TSHA Online.org handbook, ThoughtCo, History.com, and HistoryNet. All of this person, who I'm not going to tell you the name right now. But I am in the first sentence, so never mind. So Manuel Hidalgo y Costilla was born in, and I'm so going to pronounce these names wrong because
already have.
I know. Which one? Hidalgo is right.
Castilla.
Miguel. Okay, Castilla. So Miguel Hidalgo y Castilla. Sorry, cannot speak foreign languages at all, despite taking 4 years of French.
You speak English really well, though.
I do. I am very, very good at English most of the time, except when I mispronounce my own name, which, to my defense, is actually German.
Technically, you're right.
Yes. So he was born in... Now you have me all nervous.
I just acknowledge that you pronounce things wrong. It's not a big deal.
Please don't write me and tell me that I'm stupid. I'm aware. Coralejo, near Hacienda, near Guadalajara. No, that's not the correct country.
Guadalajara?
Yeah.
That's a state.
Yes, but it's not in Mexico.
Yeah.
Is it? Okay. I thought it was in a different country. See, I'm not good at geography either.
Remember Kiki Camarena went to Guadalajara for his, when I wrote about Kiki Camarena.
Yeah, I remember the person.
He was in Guadalajara for his foreign post at the DEA.
Why was I thinking Cuba for Guadalajara?
I have no idea.
Ricky Ricardo, maybe, singing the song on the show.
Because I got really good at typing Guadalajara.
Okay, anyway, this is Guanajuato. I don't know. It's a place in New Spain. Not sure.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, on May 8th, 1753, he was the second born out of 11 children, because that's what you do then, to Cristobal Hidalgo y Castilla, who was the administrator of the hacienda for the absentee owner. They were, both he and his wife, Ana Maria Galaga Mondarte, a villasor, were Creole. They were from Spain. They were not Creole. They were, what's the other one? Not the Creole, but the ones that came from Spain.
Oh, yeah.
I have it written in here somewhere, but I can't think of it. Anyways, but their children were Creole because they were Spanish, but they were born in the New World. Mm-hmm. So that's what they called them, which is Spanish citizens that were born in the colony. Anyway, in New Spain, the social order was determined by where you were born. If you were of European descent and born in Europe, you were better. If you were of European descent and born in the New World, you were okay. If you were mixed,
not good.
No go. And they were very discriminatory towards the Creoles, even though they were of European descent. They still could not hold certain positions in the government. They couldn't hold certain positions in the military. They were just less than because they were born in the New World. And so nevertheless, it was a pattern that created these two groups then were constantly vying for power, and it was very tense between these two groups because they both saw themselves as better, but they were still, you know, the people that were born here, the Creoles, were not better, according to the way it went. So this rift continued, and it started to get worse. This big tension, even though the society is already divided because the Indians and the person of mixed blood outnumbered them 10 to 1. So you've got this large population of people that the rich people look down on, as you do in a lot of the New
World places. I feel like that's still happening.
Probably, yeah. So sadly, mom died when Miguel was only 9, and he was very close to her. And so when he was 12, daddy sent him and his older brother, Jose Joaquin, to the city of Valladolid to continue their education. The school that they went to was run by Jesuits, and both decided that they were going to become priests. That was a way that they could make names for themselves, was through the Catholic Church. They still could not move all the way up because they were still Creoles. But
priest is a pretty prominent position in life. So.
Yes, in those days especially.
Yeah.
So they both were very good students. Hidalgo distinguished himself as a good student. He made very high marks. He completed his coursework at Colegio de San Nicolas. He studied philosophy and theology at the Royal Pontifical University of Mexico and graduated in 1773, and he won many debates and honors as a student. It was the established policy of the Spanish crown to entrust the most noble and most powerful posts to only the Spanish-born officials. So he's only going to get so far. Thus, viceroys, treasurers, bishops, generals, all the people and generals occupied the highest paying and most desirable posts were transplants from Spain. You could not be a Creole and be in those positions. The Creole men were barred from these influential positions, and immigrant Spaniards benefited from the policy, rejoiced in myth that men born and reared in a tropical climate of the Americas lacked the physical and mental stamina of Europeans.
I beg to differ.
I would think, well, not I would think, it is, it may have been the exact opposite, because you're born in this tough climate and you have to like have grit to survive.
Yeah, that's how I'm thinking about it. And it's like, Europe was built. It was built up.
They didn't need to do anything or work hard.
In the Americas, in the 1700s,
if you wanted a house, you had to build it. You couldn't buy one because there wasn't one.
Yes.
They're not as physically stamina, have as good physical stamina as the Europeans. So anyway, the maligned Creoles, often the son of very influential Spanish people, had to seek careers in lower the government and clergy and military. So he was ordained a priest in 1778, and he returned to Colegio de San Nicolas to teach philosophy. He studied Latin, grammar, theology, and eventually took the position of the treasurer, secretary, and vice rector of the school. Typical of the time, Father Hidalgo was a priest. However, he also has his family.
Wait, how does he have a family?
Because he had sex anyway. He just didn't get married.
I mean, I guess a lot of priests did that.
Yes, a lot of priests did that, including one pope, who we've talked about before.
Yeah.
So he had several children out of wedlock. He socialized freely. He bought properties. So, you know, not taking that vow of poverty very seriously either, like many of them. But he was a product of the time. And he was also becoming very enamored with Enlightenment thinkers.
Oh, interesting.
Who were, you know, their ideas were spreading in other places like France, America, North America, etc.
That's interesting.
Yes. Yeah, so he's very in raptured with these thinkers, and he starts to host gatherings in his home where he talks about and has discussions on whether it is the duty of the people to obey or overthrow an unjust tyrant. he's starting to see the Spanish crown as an unjust tyrant. He felt that a royal collection of debt had ruined the finances of his family, and he saw their injustices, the crown's injustices, daily with the poor that he was working with. He keeps advancing in his career as far as he can. He eventually becomes the rector of San Nicolas in 1790, but the people didn't really like all of his running around and his little parties where they talk about things like, you know, how bad the king is. And so he was accused of mismanaging funds and left the school in 1792. He had a short stint in Coloma and San Felipe Torres Mocas, I'm guessing. He eventually moved to Dolores in 1803 to replace his brother who had recently passed away.
His brother was also a priest.
His brother was also a priest, and he was the parish priest of Dolores. So Miguel goes to take over Joaquin's spot.
Got it.
In Dolores. He loved Dolores. He thought this was a great place. He stayed very busy. He started really trying to improve the community. He did his parish duties. He studied. He studied languages. He worked in vineyards. He started olive groves and vineyards. He opened a pottery making plant. His idea was to start these little cottage industries where he could give the people of Dolores a future. He wanted them to have a career where they could actually earn a decent living and do something
for
themselves.
That sounds like a nice afternoon to me. A little wine tasting, right? Maybe
have
like
olive oil and
olive
bread.
Olive oil and bread, and then like shop for some pottery.
There was also a leather tanning shop, and he, you know, there's all kind of carpentry, blacksmithing. You could go get some nice gates for your house, your hacienda. Yeah, just a pleasant afternoon. So while in Dolores, he becomes involved in this in these intellectual circles, which would meet under the auspices of intellectual discussions. But what they're really discussing is how much the king sucks.
Yeah, I mean, what else would you talk about?
Right. So the conspiracy, so they end up starting to kind of turn to, hey, you know what? We could get rid of this guy and do this ourselves, but it's all very hush-hush until it's not. And eventually his, the conspiracy, they're like, well, we need a leader. We need someone with the moral authority and a relationship with the lower classes, which, you know, let's get Father Hidalgo on our side here. And so he's buys it. He's all in. And he sets his parishioners to work. He's got this pottery and these blacksmith shops and these tanners. So pretty soon, we're making lances and slings and swords.
Just happened to be making
armor.
An whole arsenal of weapons.
Yes! What a smart thing for the little cottage industry to be doing. Around the same time, in France, the revolution has happened and it was awful and da-da-da-da, Napoleon Bonaparte comes in. And when he becomes emperor, he decides that he's going to take over all of this other territory. And in 1808, he forces out King Ferdinand the VII and puts his brother Joseph Bonaparte in charge. So Mexico does not like this, much like the other colonies. They're like, no, we don't want to be part of Bonaparte's thing. So they start getting a little more open about their activities under the disguise of, we want Bonaparte out and Ferdinand back.
Oh, yeah. They're blaming it. Yeah.
But they really don't want anybody.
No.
But this is a way that they can do this. So Hidalgo and his allies formulate plans to overthrow the regional viceroy and establish a ruling body loyal to the imprisoned Ferdinand. So they say. The societies they formed were, they professed outwardly loyalty to Spain, but secretly they were designed to come up with independence for Mexico. They don't want a king at all.
Yeah, I'm sure that was like a pretty veiled.
Yes. So Hidalgo and several of his friends engage in preparations. They start, because obviously this is treasonable, they're keeping things secret, and it's only a secret until it's not a secret. And so it gets found out, and much like what happened with Catherine the Great, okay, if we're going to do this, we got to do it now. Mm-hmm. So he was warned of his impending arrest by a friend, and Hidalgo gathers several hundred of his parishioners on September 16th, 1810. They seize control of a prison in Dolores.
Oh, Mexican Independence Day.
Yes, that is what this is.
Got it.
Yeah. So they seize control of a prison in Doris, in Dolores. Not Doris. Doris is a different town.
Doris is, you know, way further.
I've literally had half a drink. I'm just really tired. Early that morning, he rings the church bells at his parish, and he issues this from his pulpit. He says that they are announcing their intentions to strike for independence, and he pleaded with the people of Dolores to join him. This famous speech is known as the Grito de Dolores, or the Cry for Dolores. And it was intended to rally the people to arms. He waved a banner of the Virgin of Guadalupe, and it worked. Within minutes, he had an army of 600 people. Like, boom, army.
I'm kind of remembering, like, bits and pieces of this from my college Mexican history class.
Oh!
That I did take a Mexican history class in college, so, but... Yeah, I have no retention of, like, the actual.
Who taught that? Was it our sexy professor?
No, it was an older gentleman. I think his last name was Peterson or something like that. He was, like, just pretty old, and he talked and talked and talked. Like, he knew this stuff so well. He didn't have to, I mean, he just rattled it off, and you wrote as fast as you could write. And back then, being a younger person, not like now, but I remember sitting next to this older woman in my class who was probably 50. And I was like,
you thought she was super old.
Yeah. And we both like just wrote as fast as we could. And then we would trade notes with each other.
Oh, smart.
Because you'd always miss something.
Right.
And I was like,
the idea is you might miss different things.
She's my best friend because he talked so fast.
Wow.
Really interesting though. Really, yeah. really interesting.
I miss taking history classes at Chico State. I just absolutely loved it. I took South American history for my...
Yeah, mine history. Was for my theme. So I took... it was like...
The themes.
So back then, I don't know if they still do it. I think they still do. But this, all the California state schools, you had this theme class. Mm-hmm. Or theme...
It was a trio of classes. You had to take three classes. I took artificial intelligence because I had to have a science.
Yeah, I took Mexican history, I took art and culture of Mesoamerica, and then I took something else. I don't remember the third one.
I don't remember what my theme was, but I know I took my artificial intelligence class there. And we had to write a term paper, and I did the history of artificial intelligence because I didn't care anything about it, nor did I understand half the class.
I don't even really understand it. So, and but that was in the 90s. How could we even...
Right. What was artificial intelligence in the 90s?
I know.
Well, I talked about the guy that played chess, the robot that played chess, which played Napoleon, by the way, and it was actually a person inside, but they didn't reveal that until later, years later.
Oh, that was a person?
Mm-hmm.
I did not know
that.
It was
a person. What was it? Something the Turk?
Fakers.
Yes. All right. So anyway, little Hidalgo here, instantly 600 army strong. They start marching across the Bayo. Hidalgo and his followers took another town without firing a shot. They just walked in. They said, if you are Spanish, we're going to slit your throat. And they opened up the city gates. They're like, okay, we give. Come on in.
They probably were like, we've been waiting for you.
Yep. So they jailed the Spanish. They took them hostage. They took their money, property, and seized the funds to start building their war chest. In the start of this, he drops the pretense pretty quickly. So he drops the, we're going to put back the king, to we're going to be our own country, really quickly. And he realizes that he needs help. He can't do this on his own. He's a priest. Not a military person. Mm-hmm. So he finds Ignacio Allende, who was a fiery, multi-talented young regimental captain who was from Bayo of San Miguel. And he is also a Creole. So he is very frustrated with the fact that he can only go so far in his career. But he's very military. He's very He's a superb horseman. He's an exemplary soldier. He is an amateur matador. He's a gambler. He's a womanizer. Gets along great with Hidalgo for that reason.
He sounds like a swashbuckler.
He's a swashbuckler, man. But he can only go so far, and he's frustrated about it. He and Hidalgo don't like each other, though, surprisingly. Probably because they're competing for the same chicks. No, I'm kidding. I have no idea. Don't quote me on that.
Probably because they're both trying to be, like, the big A1s.
Dog. Yeah, they both want to be big dog. Anyway, so he joins the cause, and with the military captain, and now you've got the military captain as the second in command, Hidalgo is the first, and they've got the charismatic person, hey, let's all come together, come after me, we're gonna do this, and they have the military leader who can do stuff. The Native Americans and the Creoles in the neighboring towns start joining them, and they make this really crazy makeshift army that's threatening to become out of control. It's threatening to become more mob and less army.
I can see, yeah, that I can see that going south.
So they're kind of like, you know, having trouble with this. The two leaders disliked each other fiercely, but they saw the need for each other. Olindo's vision was that he was going, like you said, he wants to be in the head, and he's going to be the head of this triumphant rebel army. And Hidalgo's vision was a bunch of people with pitchforks and shovels going in and saying, yeah, we're in charge now. So they want the same thing, but they want it in two different ways. The angry rabble does get out of hand. They end up going into a town and looting and killing all the Spanish that they could find. On September 26, 1810, they reach the mining city of Guanajuato, where the Spanish and the royalist forces barricade themselves in the granary. We're not coming out. We're going to sit here with the grain, and you guys just have fun in the city.
Yeah. They're like, this is all we can do.
Yes. The battle became known as the Siege of Guanajuato, and it was absolutely horrible. The rebel horde, which was closer to Hidalgo's vision, was 30,000 people strong, and they went in and slaughtered over 500 Spanish people inside the city. And the town was looted, and, you know, the town was no more. The Hidalgo was unable to curb this excess violence, but they're keeping going. He's going to push it on. So he's going to Valladolid and Toluca. Their army is now 80,000 people strong, which, you know, 80,000 undisciplined people is going to be very difficult to
control.
That's
a crap ton of people.
It's a crap ton of people. That's and like, they're angry.
That's like a college football stadium where people care about college football.
Yeah.
And you and try to get them weapons to all do the same thing, mm-hmm, and listen to one person. No.
It's not going to happen. No, they're going to be crazy. So they're continuing on to try to get to Mexico City. The Viceroy in Mexico City organizes the defense. He sends out the Spanish general Torquato Trujillo with 1,400 men, 1,000 infantrymen, 400 horsemen, and 2 cannons.
That's still a lot of people to manage for one person.
Right, but these are military men. These are trained people know what they're doing.
They're a unit.
Yes, so there's 1,400 people in a unit against 80,000 mobsters. That are not mobsters like as in criminals, like a mob of people.
Yeah.
With pitchforks.
And no idea what to do.
What to do. The two armies clash on Monte de la Cruces, the Mount of the Crosses, on October 30th, 1810. And you can guess, the royalists fought bravely. A young officer named Agustin de Iturbide distinguished himself. I am so sorry, Mexico, for pronouncing your heroes' names or your villains' names incorrectly. Just
we're not foreign language
we're
experts.
Not foreign languages people. It would be like if someone was calling, I can't even think of what it would be. Jorge Washington. That's fine. I don't know what I'm saying. You may not know what you're saying. It's fine. Anyway, they fought bravely, but they took the two cannons. The rebels took the cannons from the royalists. So now they've got cannons. There are 80,000 people who don't know what they're doing with cannons. Because that's fun.
That's scary.
Now this is where Hidalgo makes a huge mistake. So they're right on the outset of Mexico City. They've beaten the people that were sent out to defend Mexico City. But instead of going in, he paused. He just hangs there for a while.
No.
Yes. Don't know why. And Allende tried to get him to go in. He begged and begged and begged. And Hidalgo was like, no, we're going to hang here for a while.
We're just going to chill for a minute.
We're going to chill for a minute.
I'm watching TikTok.
That's what he was doing. He was picking up a dance move so that he could perform the show at the end. Sorry. Tired. Not real drunk, just punch drunk, because tired. Anyway, some people were saying that he wanted to spare the citizens of Mexico City the inevitable sacking and plunder because he cannot control his people. And he knows they would just go in and go nuts.
That makes sense.
Yes, and that does make sense to me too. So in any event, he ends up retreating. And because the people, you know, the Spanish come in, and this gave the Royalist Army an opportunity to catch up and bring in more forces, and it's just bad. So while they're hanging out, a lot of people are like, hey, I'm not mad anymore. I'm going to go home.
They're just like, I'm over it.
So he loses a lot of people because they just desert.
That might be a good thing, though.
Yeah. He eventually regroups and forms a provisional government and decrees an end to slavery and the restitution of lands of the indigenous people. The rebels split for a while, and Allendale goes his way, and Hidalgo goes his way. And on January 11th, 1811, Hidalgo concentrated his men at Calderon Bridge, just outside Guadalajara.
Guadalajara! That reminds me of Ugly Betty. Remember, she's wearing that poncho in like one of the first episodes?
I have not seen anything but the end of that. Oh, I watched like the last two
seasons.
It's
so cute. But anyway, so she shows up to her job at Mode, which is a fashion magazine, mm-hmm. and she's wearing this poncho that says like, Guadalajara.
All I can hear is Desi Arnaz singing Guadalajara.
I love Ugly Betty, by the way, and the girls would like it. So
we need to find it, because I think they would too.
Yeah.
And we need a new show. We just finished Wynonna Earp.
Oh.
Which is pretty cute. It's a little out there. But anyway, the rebels suffer a devastating defeat. And they all just run away.
They're like, oh, bye. Lost that one. Okay, bye.
Going back to my farm. The two men eventually reunite again. But things are very tense for them because, you know, the other guy was right. The military guy was right.
Also don't like each other.
They don't like each other. So Spanish General Felix Calleja and his army ends up catching up with the rebels at Calderon Bridge near the entrance to Guadalajara on January 17, 1811. And Calleja was vastly outnumbered, but he was lucky, and there was a cannonball that exploded near the munitions wagon. So boom, all their ammo's gone.
That's not good.
No, because you need that.
Did they purposely try to take out the munitions, or was it an accident?
I don't know. The thing that I read said it was a lucky break.
Oh, okay. So it could go either way.
It could go either way, because I would think if you were a military tactician, you would try to take out the munitions. That seems like a reasonable thing to do.
But when you're talking about an unruly mob of people that don't know what they're doing.
No, this is the Spanish. The Spanish took out the unruly mob's munitions.
Oh, got it.
Yes, the Spanish are winning.
So they might have exploded their own accidentally.
Well, it says on January 11th, no, the rebels split for, no. Okay, let's find the right spot. Although Calleja, who is Spanish, was vastly outnumbered, he caught a break when a lucky cannonball exploded a rebel ammunition wagon. So I don't know where the cannonball came from. It could have come from him. It could have come from them. From the
friendly fire. Or lucky hit.
Or lucky hit, yeah. But that seems like a reasonable thing to do. You'd want to take out your...
Complete sense.
Yes. Anyway, so weapons gone. Boom. In the ensuing smoke and fire and chaos, the undisciplined soldiers ran away.
I probably would too.
Me too. And that didn't, you know, they're kind of over by this point. There was also a newspaper for a moment, a revolutionary newspaper called the American Alarm Clock. But it was very short-lived. And I'm not sure where that fits in, but I wrote it down. So I'm telling you about it.
The American Alarm Clock. That's a good name.
El Desperado Americano. Hidalgo and Allende were forced to head north to the United States. They wanted to join up with another group in around what is now San Antonio and to get more weapons and more mercenaries and more people. But Ayondo is done with Hidalgo. He's tired of his annoyance. And so he arrests him and they go north with Hidalgo as Allende's prisoner.
My favorite restaurant is in San Antonio.
I've never been to San Antonio.
It's called Ocho. If you ever go to San Antonio, I'm talking to all of you right now, go to Ocho for breakfast. Their coffee's great. They have really great breakfast. It's open late night too for after thing, and it's so adorable. Hmm. It's so cute.
We will have to go there someday. So he goes north as a prisoner, and in the north, they are betrayed by someone, and everybody is... In the north, they are betrayed by insurrection leader Ignacio Elizondo, and Allende and Hidalgo are both captured. So they were turned over to the Spanish. Here you go. Here's the bad guys in the city of Chihuahua. And they were sent to the city of Chihuahua to stand trial. They also captured some other leaders, and everybody starts, you know, getting in trouble. Most of them are given a trial and found guilty, except for one man, Albasolo, who was sent to Spain to serve a life sentence. So Allende, Jimenez, and Alameda were executed on June 26, 1811. They were shot in the back as a sign of dishonor. Hidalgo, being a priest, gets to, in addition to his criminal trial, undergo a civil trial and a visit to the Inquisition.
Oh, he made it to the Inquisition.
He made it to the Inquisition, Mel Brooks. And he was eventually stripped of his priesthood and found guilty and executed on July 30th. The heads of Hidalgo and Allendale and some other people were preserved and hung from the four corners of the granary in Gualanarto, as a warning to those who would follow in their footsteps. Do not try to be independent.
That's a hefty warning.
Yes, it was not a deterrent because the uprisings continued even in the absence of their spiritual leader. And Mexico eventually achieved their independence in 1821. 10 years later, they fought for another 10 years.
Oh my gosh.
They've already been fighting for what? 3-4 And now they fought for another 10.
That's so long.
To become independent.
I mean, I guess it was worth it for Mexico.
Yes. Ironically, it was the royalists made up of Mexican and Spanish descent and other conservatives who ultimately brought about independence in 1820. Liberals took power in Spain and the new government promised reforms to appease the Mexican revolutionaries because Spain is probably getting tired of this too. They've been fighting this war for a ridiculous amount of time. In response, Mexican conservatives called for independence as a means for maintaining their privileged existence in Mexico because they were the fancy people.
Of course they wanted to maintain that.
Yeah. In early 1821, the leader of the royalist forces, Agustin de Iturbide, negotiated the plan of Iguala with Vincent Guerrero.
That means equality.
Yes. And the plan was established in Mexico as an independent constitutional monarchy with a privileged position of the Catholic Church would be maintained, and the Mexicans of Spanish descent would be regarded as equal to pure Spaniards, and Mexicans of pure and Indian mixed blood would have lesser rights. So they're still with the class system, but the Creoles are now equal to the
They just Spanish. Couldn't not.
They couldn't, yeah.
Yeah.
We have to still be better than you, even though you were born here and you lived here way before us. On the day of September 16th, the day Hidalgo gave his original speech, has since earned a recognition as Mexico's Independence Day, with the president traditionally reenacting the speech on the eve of the national holiday. Father Miguel Hidalgo was he was remembered as the father of his country and a great hero of Mexican's war for independence, and his remains were reinterred at the Angel of Independence Monument in Mexico City. And the name Hidalgo lives on through his parish town known as Dolores Hidalgo and the Mexican state of Hidalgo.
I kind of like the idea of reenacting a speech.
Yeah, because there are so many amazing speeches that we don't necessarily get to hear given in a passionate way. We just read them on a page, and that's completely different.
And it's kind of like a little pseudo competition between all the presidents to be like, oh,
I'm giving a better
you
speech.
You sucked when you gave it.
Yes. I think it would be fun to re-give a speech.
Yeah.
That would be kind of cool.
I like that.
Yeah. So Mexico's independence took a long, long time.
It did. And I'm thankful for... I love Mexico, so...
Yes, I would like to go. It has been years and years and years since I've been there.
I also love the Paloma.
I like the Paloma. It's tequila, but I tolerated it well. Hey, I know. We want sponsors. Let's see if some Mexican tourist company will sponsor us and give us a trip.
I'm not sitting through another timeshare presentation. I did that once.
We have done it once as well.
Not doing it again.
Yeah, it was difficult. But so I mispronounced half those names, probably got a bunch of facts wrong because I am not an expert.
I am also not an expert, especially with Tagalog, but
we're just definitely drunks.
Just drunks.
Maybe punch drunk today.
As always, you can contact us on Facebook at Crime and Time OTR.
On Instagram, we are Crime and Time OTR.
On Twitter, we're at Crime and Time OTR.
And our email is crimetimeotr@gmail.com. Email is where you will want to send us cocktail suggestions, things
topics,
you want to learn about. Yeah.
Or just say hi.
Or just say hi.
And we also have a new Patreon page. Yay. If you want to buy us a drink.
Buy us a drink.
So that is
patreon.com/crimeandtimeotr.
And we're going to be offering some perks for our patrons.
Absolutely. I'm excited. See you there.
Thank you for listening.